Okay, so let's see how we're doing so this week on the combinatorics problems.
How many people got all four done? No one will admit to it. Okay, I think I see teachers people here. How many people got three of them done? How many of them people got two of them done? How many people got one of them done? None of you got any of these combinatorics problems right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so that's a little depressing. Is this a function of lack of time or lack of or something else? Yeah.
I would a little bit of lack of time, but just I will say I worked pretty significantly on several of them before last class. After last class, I felt pretty confident about counting.
Right.
Except I discovered after I implemented the algorithm we had in class that it wasn't actually correct.
And oh, really?
Yeah, and then I went through and said, oh, yeah, it's not correct because of this. Ooh, but it wasn't obvious how to generalize it. So I spent a little time on that.
So why is it? So let's just take a look at that. Maybe let's just discuss that briefly because I'd like to know. Why isn't the counting algorithm correct?
Because we're always adding at the end of a sequence, right?
Yeah.
That means that you could never have, like, a 3 at the end of the sequence because you're always adding either a 1 or a 4.
Why? No, I mean, the argument that we had there was, if I remember correct, was that f of n was equal to something like 2 times f of n minus 1 plus f of n minus 2 plus f of n minus 3. And that third term was counting how many ways there were.
Right, right. And that's, okay. I'm going to have to go through it again.
Okay, so yeah.
But yeah, I came up with something that I thought, this doesn't cover that. I'll have to figure out.
Okay, fair enough. So this is a little bit depressing. Okay, yes.
My problem was I had trouble using big num in this algorithm. Had to apply that so that it could add big num. Big num.
Okay, so we had problems with big nums. Okay.
Yeah. You mean in Java? You tried to use Java big nums? Okay. Okay. So I agree that it is unfortunate that these problems combined big num issues with counting issues, and that's life. Anybody else want to? What's your story? Can you pass a matrix in C++ as a parameter? I would assume so. Usually the question is whether you want to pass it a pointer to it. Usually you pass a pointer to it because that changes it. Is that what you wanted to do, or you wanted to make a local copy of the matrix and pass a copy of the matrix? So that's a pointer, right? Okay, so the usual way to do that would be by passing a pointer around. Okay, anything interesting to talk about on any of these, or are people sort of disgusted with counting and don't want to count anymore?
We didn't discuss about the other problem, which I was kind of interested in. The
sequencing one. Okay. Let's see if we can figure that one out, okay? This is how many people thought about this last one, the self-describing sequence? Okay.
I actually figured out what it was about that other one.
So what is it that you didn't like about the stuff?
Right now we have the third term is 1 plus, or a multiple of 1 times f of n minus 3, right?
Yeah.
So in the first case you only have, say a 1 and a 4, right?
Yeah.
Or the first step.
Yeah.
So when you are looking at this in, say, the first iteration of this, which would be f of 4, you're going to get, and we can simplify it by just saying instead of 1 and 4, we should have to say 1.
F of 4 you want to know, right?
Then we want to get both 3, 1 and 1 3.
And 1 3. Okay.
But I don't think we're going to get both of those.
Well, what do we now know? How many ways are there to come up with a number of n? The threes, this counts how many ways there are to have one where 3 is the last digit. And to be precise, you also want to have 3, 4, and
right.
4, 3, right?
Right?
So how are these going to get counted? Well, how many, let's take a look at the first case. How many, what are the basis cases we needed? F1, F2, F3, right? How many ways are there to make a number 1? 2. How many ways are there to make a number 2? 5? Is that what we agree on? How many ways are there to make a number 3? 13. You're convinced with us. That's in the book. So obviously you assume that that is correct, right? The book isn't wrong. So now what would F of 4 be? Do you know what F of 4 is in real life?
No. I know what it is for, I tried to break it down. So I don't
Otherwise, what I would argue is the following, that the last digit of any number, we can group all the representations of 4, into those whose last digit is 1, whose last digit is 4, whose last digit is 2, and whose last digit is 3. Right? Is there any other possibility?
Also group it with like 4 and the second and the last.
I may even group it in different ways, but this is how I'm going to group it. Okay, so you tell me how I'm thinking about it. How many ways are there that end in 3? Well, I want to argue that once we decide it ends in 3, we want to know how many ways are there to write the number 1 first, right? Okay, so once we've decided it's going to end in 3, if we want to represent 4 and end in 3, we still have a 1 to represent. It's basically how many ways are there to represent 1. You tell me that there are 2 ways to do that. Right? Isn't that what this recurrence is saying? How many ways are there to end in 2? Well, any way that you have, if once you end in 2, that means before this, you want to have it end in, you want to have the number 2 represented. How many ways are there of doing that? 5. If I end in 4, how many ways are there of doing it? I have to represent 3. How many ways are there to represent 3? So I would argue that there are 26 plus 7 ways to do it. You still agree? Is that what you agreed your answer should be?
That's what we got last time. That made sense.
Okay, well then I'll claim it still makes sense to me until you come up with a contradiction. Okay, any questions? Okay, so I'm sorry that people had a rough time counting.
Let's move on, I guess. Unless the people want to try to take a look at the self-describing sequence one, that's fine. Maybe people can salvage some honor on that one. Okay, so what is the problem here again?
The problem is, we are given a sequence of the form such that we have numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, dot, dot, dot. We told there's 1, 1, there are 2 2s, 2 3s, 3 4s, and so on. And you want to now know what is, if this is f, if this is the function f, this is n, this is f of n, what is f of n for a particular value? Okay? Does everybody understand the problem? So how could we go about this? Okay? Any ideas? We agree we could construct the entire function, but that takes too much memory. We actually have to construct it. Okay? Now, Any ideas what we might be able to do? Something, some
tighter way we could compress all of these. Okay, let's think about it this way. Represent the problem is that that's going to make 2 billion memory cells, right? And that is a lot. So any way that we could represent fewer, represent this with fewer memory cells, describe that function in fewer memory cells. Yeah.
What I did for my initial thought was to say, okay, well, we have 1 1, 2 2s, 2 3s, okay. And I'm thinking, okay, maybe I can compress this by going, okay, it's always going up by one, and I know and I can represent the number of times each number happens. Maybe I can come up with some kind of pattern there. And it follows the same kind of pattern, but I was unable to generalize it.
Okay. Well, now you're okay. So I would say that you're trying to look at this function. This function is a weird function to me, and I would not assume it has any properties of interest. Okay, it's my immediate way of thinking. Is there any more compact way we can represent this function that comes to mind, other than explicitly listing an array telling us what f of n is for every n? Okay.
I guess what I was saying isn't necessarily that there's like a direct function that you could generate, but that the array that you want to create can be compressed by saying that the number of each particular value that you have is represented by that by the same string. So we have 1 1, 2 2s, 3 2 3s, 3 4.
Okay, so you want to compact the array matrix. I want to claim you want to have something like this.
Maybe.
What you're sort of saying is something like this. That you really want to know where is it that let's sort of compute the inverse of f of n in some sense. Namely, sort of where does and start. Okay? Suppose I give you, let's say that we can represent this function. Suppose I know where n starts for every n. So where does 1 start in this function?
1.
1. Where does 2 start?
2.
3 start?
4.
4 start.
6.
5 start.
Nine.
First question is, suppose I give you this function now. Could you figure out what the value of f of n is? Okay, suppose this tells you that for every integer, you know, basically where does its run start? Could you solve our original problem if you had this problem? You had this function. And so how?
And let's say n is equal to 3, it's between 2 and 4. So it'll have to be 2.
So what you're saying here, that if you wanted to figure out what it was, if I had this function stored in an array, how would I find out what the value, what f of n is? Would it just be binary search on this array for what n is and figure out where it was? So what's f of 5? What's f of 5?
3.
Well, it's got to be it's got to be a 3 because it's between 3 and 5 and between 4 and 6, right? Does everybody agree with that? Now, how big is this function going to be? Up to n. How far? In other words, if I want to compute f of n for some value of n here, let's say the largest n was 2 billion, right? So I need to know the value is going to end at 2 billion. How big a table will I likely need 2 billion? No, not 2 billion. We've left, it's clearly at least 2 billion minus one, because I don't have 3 here. And I don't have 5 here, and if we keep going, I'm gonna not have more and more of them.
But you're still gonna need 2 billion elements, right?
No, I'm gonna have values up to 2 billion. But I wanna really know what is the real interesting is, what is the integer n prime? Such that its run starts in around the 2 billionth position. Right? That's the largest answer you might possibly return. Okay, does everybody sort of see that? See what I'm saying? Or if not, questions are good. Sort of kind of a gross idea as to how big that would be. It's very large, we're in trouble. Okay? But how large do we think that might be? Any gross sense? I have a guess. I'm not sure I can prove it exactly, but I think I have a sense. Want to make a guess? Any guesses? Do you have any guesses?
Well, yes, I think it's square rootish.
Yeah, okay, square rootish is exactly what I'm thinking. Why am I thinking square rootish? Because suppose, let's say, that we did have exactly 1 1, 2 2s, 3 3s, 4 4s. By the time I fill n elements here, basically this is going to be how many slots will I fill? It's the sum as I goes from 1 to, it'd be something like this. I equals from 1 to n of I. That's n squared. Okay? So my hunch is that the size of the table is square rootish. Okay, I'm not sure. I mean, this is my intuition. Basically, I think your intuition. How big is square root of? What is the square root of 2 billion? Tens of thousands is perfectly harmless, right? Okay. The other question is, can we now compute this function? Okay. So I think this is not going to be too big. Okay, I might be wrong, but that's what I think. Does everybody see why that sort of is? Or if not a question, it's fine. The other question is, can you compute this function? Suppose I know that this is true. That the run before start at 5, 6. Where do the runs of 5 start? Why? Okay, why? Can you figure out what this value is? Given this information, how many 5s, basically how many 5s and where will they start? Or where will the 5 start? Okay. Any ideas? I think that you should be able to figure this out from the information we have. Any ideas? What's going to govern where the 5 start? You know where the 4s start, right?
Right. How many 4s there are.
How many 4s are there?
3.
Well, how do you find out? Okay.
Oh, the same way. You're just going to move backwards.
You move backwards. It's going to tell you how many 4s there are, right? Because you want to know what's in the 4th position. The 4th position is here, right? This tells you where is the run of 3 started in the 4th, I think there's going to be 3 4s, right? So I want to tell you that basically by taking this value and looking up the appropriate table entry, you can compute the next one. Okay? Does everybody agree with that? Okay? And I think together, if we take that in mind, I think that gives us at least a gross idea of a scheme to do this. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay? And I think that will do the job. Okay? So that might be one, if you want to salvage your honor on an accounting problem, this might be a way to do it. Okay? Any questions about that? It maybe you don't even need to keep this whole function around, but I think it's probably a useful thing. Okay? And if you can fit it in memory, I think that's a good thing. Does everybody see the trick that we used here? So some of you see what this inverse function is like. Okay? The key notion here is that instead of keeping track of explicitly what the value of every function is, we're only going to keep track of where does it change. Yes, that's what we need to do. And I claim that the place where basically the starting point of the fives is going to be equal to the starting point of the fours plus the number of fours. So it's sort of a recursive kind of an idea, right? But this is, if you're building a table of this function, this you already have, and the number of fours is determined by looking it up using that table. So I want to say, in general, that gives you a way to do it. Okay? I mean, replace, you know, uses large values of 4 and 5. Okay? This is the idea. Any questions? Okay? And this may be a reasonable thing to do. Is this how you did it, or you don't remember? You remember how you did it? So you actually had enough space to tabulate this function. Okay? So, yeah. So that's the right way to do it.
Okay? Any questions? Okay, is that cute? Good. Okay, let's okay, so any other questions about counting? If not, I'd like to move on to the next section, which is, again, it's another mathematically oriented class of problems on number theory. And maybe we'll review the number, the problems before we get into the theory of it. Okay? So, first of all, how many of you know anything about number theory? Seen something about number theory, like number theory?
A little bit.
Okay. Number theory is really great stuff. Okay, but you have to learn, you know, in order to do something interesting with it, you have to learn something. So we'll try to review, and it's probably a lot like combinatorics. Combinatorics is great stuff, okay, but you have to learn something in order to do it. We'll talk a little bit, and you know, to say you're going to learn number theory in a week is not a completely fair task. But let's look at the problems and see if we can find some that might be, you know, tractable. Okay. The first problem. So number theory has to do with prime numbers. A lot has to do with prime numbers. It has to do with multiplication. It has to do with division and properties of integer division and multiplication. So the first problem asks. Okay, which composite integers n satisfy the equation that a to the n equals, okay, so I want to know, if I give you an integer a and an integer a, is a to the n mod n equal to a? Okay, let's think about this. Suppose n was, give me a number n. Give me a nice number n. 10. Let's write 10. Okay? 10 is a nice number n. Okay? Now, would we expect that a to the 10th mod n, 10, is equal to a for all a from 1, let's say, 1 to n, or let's say 0 to n minus 1.
Okay? Is this always true? Is there any value of A for which that's true?
Let's think about it.
Well, first of all, you got a problem. What is A to the 10th mod, you know, A to the 10th mod 10? What is 2 to the 10 mod 10? 2 to the 10 is not such a big number, okay? 2 to the 10 is a 1,000, right? Okay? So it's 1,024. 1,024 mod 10 is 4, right? Mod is the remainder. So is 4 equal to 2? That's really what this would be saying. And the answer is no. Okay? And if you think about it, it's fairly unlikely if you have an N here, you pick an A at random, that this equation should exactly be satisfied. Just sort of looking at this thing, should this equation be true? Okay? And the interesting thing is it is always true if N is prime. Okay? But shouldn't usually be true if N is composite. Okay? And my argument is you can give a proof that it's true for N equals is prime. That's number theory thing. We won't go into it, but it's a classic result. But this is the idea behind a lot of randomized primality testing algorithms. Suppose I give you you know what a prime number is? A prime number is a number that can't be divided. You know, it has non-trivial factors other than 1 in itself. Right? So, what are the first few prime numbers?
2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19,
dot, dot, dot. So how do you test if a number is prime?
Okay, does anybody remember how to do that?
Basically, you can take all the numbers from prime to two and work the way up and find that that divides itself and you return all similar items to.
Okay, so you want to do repeated division. Okay, now what if this number is very, very, very large? How many numbers might you have to test before you do it?
Actually, you take the square root of the number
Go
from 0 to the square root.
Right, so if you're trying to prove that n is prime, the smallest prime factor of it is going to be square root n times square root n, right? So you might have to test square root n numbers. But if n has a billion digits, then you're in trouble, yeah?
You can prove it slightly by only checking the prime numbers and doing that.
Yeah, you could. Okay. But the bottom line is that for large enough n, the Dive algorithm is not going to work very well, efficiently. So how do they test this thing in practice? They use these randomized algorithms. Suppose I want to test if n is prime. One way I could do it is pick a random a, plug it into this equation, and if this equation is false, I know the number is composite. Composite means not prime. Why is that? Because this equation always holds for any a if n is prime. So if it does not hold for n is prime, for a given n and a, n cannot be prime. So what are the randomized algorithms for doing this? You pick a bunch of random a's. Try it. Does it work? If it comes out as this is not equal to that, you say composite. Otherwise, you say, well, it's probably, might be prime. And if you would figure if you try enough of them, you'll get more and more confident that the number is prime. That's the idea behind randomized primality testing, which is a cute algorithm. Now, what's the trouble? There are numbers called Carmichael numbers. What's a Carmichael number? Carmichael's a person. These are Carmichael's numbers, okay? A Carmichael number is a composite that happens to always satisfy that equation. Okay? And it can be proven that there are some composites with that property.
And your job is going to be
to try, given a given value of A, try all values of A and see whether or not this expression is satisfied for all values of A. Okay? Any questions?
And A is any number between 0 and
A. A is any number between, I think it'll tell you, between 0 or, and something or other. Now, what's the problem? 2 and n minus, right, 2 and, wait, no, that's n. I think A is for any number between 2, right, 2 and n minus 1, okay?
So what's the problem? What makes that, so it should be pretty easy, just plug in for any number from 2 to n minus 1, plug in 2 to the n, compute 2 to the n, take the remainder mod n, and see if that's A. Is there any difficulty with that?
Your n is like, say, go to 65,000.
N is 65,000.
We'll go like 60,000. We're testing, you know, on A is either 100 or
100 to the 65,000.
Right.
Okay. So you've got this problem that you want to compute remainders mod this big, this number, efficiently. Okay, that's really what the heart of this problem is. Okay, and I want to claim when we talk about modular arithmetic, you can do this without big integers, okay, if you're smart enough. Okay, and maybe we'll try to go into that material. Any questions about this? Okay, so that's basically what you want to do. Is it true for all A's that it's satisfied, for a given N that all A's satisfy this equation, and you want to try to do it without big integer arithmetic? Any questions? Okay.
The next problem is a problem where I give you an
integer A, and I give you an integer N, and I want to find out, does A divide N factorial? Okay? So let's take a look at something. Does 4 divide 5 factorial? Yeah, that's pretty obvious, right? No problem. What about this 20? Let's say 20. Does 20 divide n factorial?
Yeah.
Okay. Could someone give me an algorithm for testing this? In general, if I give you an integer a and an integer n, how do you test if a divides n factorial?
Well, there's one way to do it. Simple way to do it. Conceptually simple way to do it.
If A can be broken down,
an exceptionally simple way to do it would just be to figure out what n factorial is and try to divide it.
Right. And the problem we have here again is big integers, right?
What you can't do is break down A into, like, break down 20, as the terminology is, do 4 and 5, and see if those numbers are less than or equal to n.
So you want to say that if I factor,
that's the word.
If I factor 20 into 4 and 5, I could now see is 4, are 4 and 5 both less than this? If so, that would you say that would show that this divides that? Is that necessarily correct?
Not quite, because if you have I assume you mean less than or equal to. Then you would say that, 25. Well, 5 and 5 are less than or equal to 5.
So 25 does not divide 5 factorial, right? So here, you got to be a little bit more clever than that.
And the factors can't be equal to one another?
Well, the trouble is that once you've divided the 5 out, we'll go into the question. We'll talk a little bit about this kind of thing, but we agree that 25 does not divide 5 factorial. Why is that? Because that's 5 times 5. Yeah, once you kill one of the fives, you've got the other one there. Okay? Any questions? Okay? But again, the hope is, can we get away by being smart without using the large precision arithmetic? Any questions? Okay?
Both of these, if you see them right, I think are quite easy. Okay? So that'll hopefully spur you up a little bit, if you see it right. The next problem, 7... says that basically you have this guy who likes to collect marbles, okay? And he wants to store his collection. And the problem is is two types of boxes. One of them holds exactly N1 marbles, one of which holds exactly N2 marbles. Okay? Let's say one of them holds, let's say,
this is an example here. So one of them type of box costs, I don't know, let's say it costs $5 and can hold 7 marbles. And another one costs, $4, costs $2, but can only hold 2 marbles. Right? I want to store N marbles. I want to fill up every box completely. What is the cheapest arrangement of boxes for me to buy? So let's say I have 10 marbles. What's the cheapest? How can I get away and store 10 marbles using these boxes where I cannot allow to leave any slots left over? Yeah. I can buy 5 $2 boxes, right? Okay? Does everybody see that? There's no real other choice I have. What would be a more interesting example? Let's say I have 14. How would I get away with 14? What's the cheapest way I would do that? Do 7. What if I have 16? Okay, how do I get away with that? 772. What if I have 19? Can I get away with that? 7 and then 2, right? And what numbers can I realize? Because if you give me 5 marbles, I'm in trouble, right? Everybody agree with that? No way to store 5 marbles like this. So your problem is, given an integer n, try to figure out what's the best way, the cheapest way to sort of store the marbles. Any questions? What if I'm allowed to leave leftover marbles? Let's just think about this. Let's say if I'm allowed that extra space, what would be the cheapest way to do this? What? Let's say I have as much as I want. Yeah. What? Greedy. What does greedy mean exactly here?
The best.
What does the best mean? Cheapest per marble.
For marble, right.
So one box is that find the one that gives me the most bang for my buck, and I keep buying that. Would that necessarily be the cheapest way to do it? Right, it might very well be my last box, for example, could have, this might be that I get a great deal where I could store, a million marbles for $2. Okay, let's say $5, okay? Whereas for one marble I can pay $1. Okay. I might be better off, what would I want to do? I might be better off if I have 1,000,001 marbles to buy one of each rather than to buy 2 of the cheaper ones, right? So you have to be a little bit clever. And what's worse though is you have to be more clever even though you can't leave things left over here. But something akin to the greedy algorithm with a little bit of diddling will do that job. Basically, just the boundary case that I think is what you have to worry about. Okay? But your problem is you will have to find the cheapest way to store them exactly. Any questions here about that problem?
Final problem, which has to do with what they call repackaging. You work for a company that basically, you want to go to the store and buy 3 types of cups. You know, maybe this is
more akin to what happens to me. If you have a party, okay, forget about cups. I think forks, spoons, and knives are the right way to think about it. Okay, you have forks, spoons, and knives, right? You go to the store, you want to buy plastic silverware. You know, you want to have a party, you know, everybody needs a fork, spoon, and knife, right? Now, the trouble is that they don't sell, that, you know, if they sold a package where you had the same number of forks, spoons, and knives, then you would be happy. You could end up with, you know, one for everybody. But in fact, they don't tell you they sell packages where you can get 3 forks, 17 spoons, and 4 knives. And they'll tell you that you can buy 16 forks, 23 spoons, and 13 knives, and so on. And the question is there a way that you can buy some subset of these things such that you end up with exactly the same number of forks, spoons, and knives? Okay, you're allowed to buy multiple copies of these. Okay? There's an unlimited number on the store, on the shelf. But you want to end up with exactly the same number of forks, spoons, and knives. So everybody has one.
So those are packs that contain all three?
Every pack contains, in principle, a mix of all three. Okay? You know, and the question now is, how do you buy these things so you end up with exactly the same number of each? Okay? Any questions here? Let's try a little example here, maybe as a better thing. Suppose, let's say, that this one sells 4, 1, 1, and this one has, let's say, 1, 2, and 2. Is it possible to end up with the same number of forks, spoons, and knives? It's not obvious to me that you can. Let's try a case where we can. If we have 3 here, can we do this with 3? Is that actually doable? No, that's not clear to me either. With 2, you can do it, right?
Sure.
Then you just add by 1 of each, okay? What if, let's say, this was 4, 2, and 2? Okay. We get away with this one? Some combination of these? What is it?
1 is the first set, 2 is the second set.
Right? This is going to be, you'll get 6 of these. Does everybody agree with that? Okay. So your problem is, given a collection of possible sets of cups you can buy, tell me whether or not there's a way that I can end up with the same number of each of them. Any questions about that? Okay. So just as far as general tools that you need, the first two basically have to do with modular arithmetic. Okay, primality testing and modular arithmetic and things like that. These are relatively simple. These require more higher order thinking. Okay? So I encourage you to start with the first two before you go on to the next ones. Okay? Any questions?
Carmichael's number, the people will be confused. If it passes that test, it's a Carmichael number.
What does it say here? I have to read the problem. Okay. Because I think what it'll tell you is it's a Carmichael problem number if what? A Carmichael number is a non-prime that passes this test for every possible number. A. Right? Yeah. That's what it looks like to me. Okay, but you have to, you know, that's what you're saying, basically.
So you have to think, basically.
Okay, well, that should be within your reach. Okay, you are capable of doing two things. Yes. Okay, any questions? Okay.
I can't figure out why you bother using this, because it seems to be worthless if in some cases it fails.
Well, okay, so you're saying why would you use this if it sometimes fails? Well, suppose it fails very, very, very rarely. Okay, it depends upon why you need a prime. Okay,
an example of why this is a useful thing, this kind of a, you know, why is a randomized primality test useful? Okay? Suppose it fails very, very rarely. In certain applications, it's important to, okay, like for example, in encryption. Okay, you've probably heard of the RSA encryption algorithm. That is based on, the hardness of that is related to the hardness of factoring numbers. Okay? And somehow, the hardness requires that your key be a prime. Okay? Now, with a scheme, if you want to find a key, you want to really give it, try to test whether a number is prime. Okay? And if it's not prime, I think the system still works, although it's a little less secure. So it's not so bad. You're willing to play the game where you'll say, look, here's a number. It's almost certainly prime. It's going to be hard for anyone to crack it. Okay? You know, it's so unlikely that I gave them an easy case. I'm not going to worry about them trying to crack it by finding an easy case. Okay? So that's one reason why these things are valuable. Yeah?
I'm trying to remember what the application for this was that I heard about a problem a while ago that was basically, for all intents and purposes, impossible to solve because it would take, working any kind of universe. But it could be, you can make successive approximations and get to the point where your approximate guess was probably correct, to less of a chance than an Arduino hitting your processor and getting your wrong answer.
Yeah. So, these randomized algorithms don't guarantee the right answer necessarily, but they're so likely that it's so unlikely that they will be wrong in general. They're still a useful thing. Okay? Any questions? And they're certainly an interesting thing, at the very least that. Okay, so let's look at some of the material that can help you solve some of these problems. Okay? So, first of all, what do we know about number theory? Well, again, number theory is something that if you're into number theory, it's sort of a mystical thing. So people walk around saying things like, God created the integers, all else is the work of man. Because somehow the integers have such beautiful properties to them. They had to have been created by a divine being. So we're going to be interested mostly in the divisibility properties of integers. And we say that B divides A, which I will write as B bar A. Okay? If A is equal to B times K for some integer K. Okay? So that sort of clarifies the idea that if B divides A, A is bigger than B and there's no remainder when you divide it. Right? Okay. And we say equivalent if B is a divisor of A. Okay? If B divides A. That's sort of our notation. Okay? Okay. So what are these prime numbers? One of the problems has to do with prime numbers. We agree a prime number is an integer larger, is an integer greater than 1 that is divisible by 1 and itself. Is 1 a prime number? Why isn't 1 a prime number? Okay. Basically, because people say so. My interpretation, okay? That, somehow it's a definition, this is a prime number, okay? The main reason is because 1 is sort of a weird number, okay? And so, so it's better, it's more convenient just to have 1 not be a prime. So basically, what does it mean? It means that if you have, T is a prime number, that if A times, T is equal to A times B, one of them is going to be a 1 and the other one's going to be P. Why are prime numbers important? The real reason is something called the fundamental theorem of arithmetic. That's an impressive sounding name, fundamental theorem of arithmetic. What is the fundamental theorem of arithmetic? It basically says that every integer can be expressed only one way as the product of primes. Okay? So let's take your favorite integer. What is it? Somebody give me a favorite integer. 10. Okay, how do you express 10 as the product of primes? 2 times 5. How do you represent 12 as the product of primes? 2 through 3. So notice the primes can be repeated. When we say an integer can be represented uniquely by the product of primes, we mean that the set of primes is unique.
the ordering, if you multiply them, is not important, right? So the fact that 2, 2, 3 is the same as 2, 3, 3, 2, 2, or 3, 2, 2, two whatever. Well, primes are greater than 0, right? We said primes are greater than 0, so there are no negative primes. Oh, I can represent any integer, excuse me, any, every integer, an integer is, we'll say, is great, in his context, is greater than 1. 1 greater than 1, something like that. So negative numbers are not an issue here. Okay? Any questions? And the unique set of numbers, okay, is the, that multiplied n is called the prime factorization of n. So every integer has a unique prime factorization. Any questions about that? This is stuff you should have learned in high school, but it just reminded me. Okay? So, how do you test? Let's take a look. Okay, so how do you test if a number is prime? We sort of talked about that. Okay, there are a couple different ways to do it. Okay? Anybody know how many primes there are? Yeah. An infinite number of primes. How many of you have seen the proof that there's an infinite number of primes? Okay? Okay, this is actually, so this is, if you have it, it's in the book, and it's a very beautiful thing. Okay, and so it's one of the things I like to think that any educated person should know why there's an infinite number of primes. So I always have been tempted when I sort of, when you go to a cocktail party and you have some humanities person who's railing on about how engineers don't know anything about art or anything like that. You just tell them that they know how, why there's an infinite number of primes, yes, and show them that, and that actually will make for an interesting party. But not only are there infinite number of primes, there are a lot of primes. Okay, and it may say, well, wait, if there's an infinite number, there's a lot of them. But the truth is that actually, the primes are not only are there a lot of infinite number of primes, but they're fairly regularly spaced. Okay, and this is actually kind of an amazing thing, because if you think about it, you start out with how many even numbers are primes?
One,
two. How many multiples of three are primes? How many multiples of three are there?
Oh, one.
Okay, how many multiples of five are there that are integers, that are primes?
One.
So you would think that somehow you're canceling the even numbers. You're canceling out every hash front number, every even number. You're canceling every third number, right? You're canceling every fifth number. You would think there are not that many numbers left. Okay? In general, you could prove, and it's well beyond what we will do in a course like this, that there are x over log n primes less than x, okay? Which means that roughly one out of every log x numbers is prime, okay? So if you randomly sample, this comes in handy when you're talking about RSA keys and finding, how do you find big large primes for RSA numbers? Well, you know that one out of every log x numbers is prime, so if you try using, you know, pick log x random numbers, odds are one of them is going to be prime. So it reduces, basically, the finding primes is reducing to testing primes and testing not that many of them. So that's kind of interesting. Okay, and how do you find a prime factorization? Well, I think we agreed that repeated division is in general the easiest thing, and you only have to go up to square root n. How can you find a list of all the divisors of n? Okay? Suppose, let's say I want to find out all the divisors, integers that divide 2 billion. Can somebody come up with a way to describe all the, you know, to find all the integers that divide 2 billion? That would be one way to do it. Before I goes from 1 to 2 billion, do you divide this thing? Okay? And that's 2 billion tests, right?
If you do it by 1 billion tests, once you have a million, it's going to be reversible order.
Once you get up to a million, you're right in saying that once you get up to a billion, then in fact there's no other divisor up until 2 billion. Right? If your number is 2 billion, there is no divisor greater than, there's no divisor of n greater between n and, that's greater than n over 2 and less than n. Why is that? Yeah?
Because in order to get, you know, if you did have a number there, you would have to have a number that's between 1 and 2.
You have to have something that, if it's a divisor, you have to have, that means that this divided by this is an integer. Right? And what is the value of this divided by this? Between 1 and 2. So no integer. Right? Okay, so you're right. Now you only have to test a billion integers. Okay? But that's still a lot. Did anyone come up with a systematic way to construct divisors of an integer? Or what the relationship between divisors of integers are and prime factorizations?
It sounds like you could just try to run through just the primes up to the square root of that number to see which of those are factors.
Okay, so now what you've got is, let's say you only need to try primes up to square root n in order to find a prime factorization of the integer, right?
Right. Although, you'll have to check for duplicates.
What is the prime factorization of 2 billion?
Price of 2 billion. You can do this by hand.
It's 2 million. Let's do 2 million. It's 4 by 1. Okay? So what is the prime factorization of 2 million?
We start at 2 and say, okay, if you divide it, I guess it does. Our number goes down to 1 million. And now we start over again. So does 2 go into that? Yes, it does. We have another 2.
Okay, but how many 2s do we have? You have 2 of them so far. Now you're at a half.
500,000.
Okay.
Start 2 again. Does 2 go into it? Yes, it does. We're going to keep doing that until we get down to 2.
Okay. Until we get down to a prime number.
Until you're going to get down to something that doesn't
count. Okay?
Yeah.
How would we do this? Is there a simple way to do this? I mean, I agree with you, but that's the basic idea. How would I do this more rationally? This is 2 times 10 to the what? That's 6.
Everybody agree I was going to be better. This is 10 to the 1, 10 to the 2, 10 to the 3. Wait. 10 to the 6 is that 10 to the, wait, no. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 10 to the 6th. Okay? 2 times 10 to the 6th. Does everybody agree with that? So what is the prime factorization of 2 times 10 to the 6th? I claim, what is the prime factorization of 10? Right? So how many 2s are there in the prime factorization of 2 million here?
7.
The number of 2s is 7. The number of 5s is what?
6.
Is there any other prime factor? No. So how many divisors does this integer have? Okay. Does anybody tell me how many divisors 2 billion has? Okay, you should be, yes, you can write a program and count them. Let's think for a second, okay? Is there any way that we can use this little bit of information to tell us that? How many divisors there are?
What?
13 factorial.
13 factorial divisors. 13 factorial is larger than 10 billion.
2 to the 13th. That's what I'm thinking of.
2 to the 13th? I don't think I believe that. Why do you think 2 to the 13th?
Because you could have
any subset of these,
yes,
and any subset of those.
Right.
But is it true that any are these 2s distinct? So you want to say basically.
Oh, no, then I
that don't. Any, that what you want to say, so the idea here is
right.
Sort of right. Okay? Then any divisor of 2 billion, if it's going to divide it, what's it going to be consist of? Is it going to have a 7 in it?
No.
The Senate survives 2 billion?
No.
Why not?
It's not divisible by 2 or 5.
Right, because 7, because the way that you can tell whether a number divides another number is if you found the prime factorization of this number and the prime factorization of this number, the subset of the numbers here has to be contained within the subset of numbers here. Does everybody agree with that? Everybody agree with that? So how many different prime factorizations are there of this number? So how many different divisors of this number are there? Well, how many twos can we have? Okay? Between 0 and 7 twos. Okay? And how many sixes can we have? 5. Between 0 and 5 and 6 possibilities, right? I want to claim that there are 7, there's 7 possibilities here, 8 times there, 56 different divisors. Okay? And this is assuming that basically what you get is the answer is 1 times this. In the case of them both being zeros, when you have 0 sevens and 0 sixes, you get 1 as a divisor, right? Okay, when you get all of them, you get the number itself as a divisor, right? So I claim we can count how many divisors there are and construct them by manipulating the prime factorization. Does everybody agree with that?
Oh, I get it.
Okay, any questions about that?
Yeah.
Euler's phi function or the totient function. Yes, yeah, so if you read about number theory, people care about the function of how many divisors an integer has. And if you use Wolfram's computer algebra system, Mathematica, it's even a built-in function in Mathematica. So it's an important thing. See Mathematica at Wolf's talk on Friday. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So what does this tell us now? This gives us some way to analyze divisors, the number of divisors, and whether something is a divisor here. Is that possibly going to help us on some of these problems? Okay? Just a sort of hint. Might an idea like this be helpful on something like this? Okay, that instead of explicitly constructing n factorial, maybe by doing my machinations I can figure out whether something divides something else by storing things without multiplying them together. That's sort of a hint. Okay, so think about that. Okay, this basic idea. Any questions? Okay. Good. Okay. So what else do we have that I'd like to tell you about briefly? Let me just talk to you about, GCDs, modular arithmetic. Because modular arithmetic is you're more interested in computing remainders than quotients. Okay? Today is what? Today is, what's today's calendar date?
March 6th.
And it is a Thursday, right? So March 6th, 2003 is a Thursday. What is March 6th, 2004 going to be? Okay. Any ideas how you might compute that? Right, okay. So how many days are there going to be between now and a year from now? 366, right? Why? Because I think February 29th is going to occur next year, right? So it happens to be that it's going to be 366 days between here and there. 366 days between here and there. So what is the, what shift is there going to be in the week? I say that what you really want to know is 366 mod 7. Because every day is going to shift you one more in the cycle of the 7 days. 366 mod 7 tells you basically what day it will fall, you know, what the shift is from today. What is 366 mod 7? Okay, if you have a calculator, or you can, I think it's 2. Okay? So, if it's equal to 2, what day is it going to fall on next year? Saturday. Okay, so make plans. Okay? Any questions? But see also all the ability to do, now you can tell me, what's it going to be the year after? It's going to be Sunday the year after. And what about the year after that? Monday. Okay? Once you've done the modular calculation, now you can do this kind of stuff fast, right? Once you understand the theory. So being able to work with sort of remainders or residues mod things often gives you fast ways to compute things. So we typically, when we take a look at this thing, the number we divide by up we call the modulus. And the remainder that we leave over is called the residue. Now, how can we compute 366 mod 7 more efficiently? Okay, I mean, how did we compute what that was? Okay? Again, you could have done the division somehow and done that. Is there any more elegant way we can do this? Okay? What if we factor 366? Can we divide factor 366? I'm going to say it's 122 times 3, times 3. Is that right? Anything else that it is? Want to simplify it a little bit better? I want to say that it's 61 times 6 is also true, right? Right? Is there any other thing we can do with that? Well, how can we compute this mod 7 more easily?
I claim that that in modular arithmetic, there's certain rules that we know. X plus Y mod N is equal to X mod N plus Y mod N, totally taken mod N. Okay? X minus Y mod N is X mod N minus Y mod N, totally taken mod N. Okay? And for what we're interested in for this particular example, multiplication, x times y mod n is x mod n times y mod n mod n. Okay? So how might we have used this to compute it? What is 6 mod 7?
What is the remainder of 6 divided by 6? Okay, that I can deal with. What is 61 mod 7? Okay, I had 7 times 8 is 56, right? 7 times 9 is 63, so it didn't get up that high. So what is it?
4.
It's 5, right?
Yeah, 5.
What is 5 times 30? 5 times 6 is 30. What is 30 mod 7? 30 mod 7 is pretty easy to see, right? 4 times 7, that's 28. That's equal to 2. We get the same answer we got before, right? So in fact, what we can do is, this gives us a tool to compute the remainder of big numbers. Okay? That, that because it enables us to compute what is the remainder of a big number mod a small number by reducing it to computing the remainders of the small numbers mod that. Okay? X times Y is a big number, but X mod N is a small number. How big a number is X mod N? What's the biggest X mod N can be? N minus 1. So this reduces it to a small number. What is x to the y mod n? Okay. What is the last digit of 2 to the 100. 2 to the 100 is a big number, right? Is it a big enough number for you? It's not big enough. Let's give me another one. Let's make it 200.
I have 100 on there.
Okay. What is the last digit of 2 to the 100? Can anybody get a sense of that? How would you express that using a modular arithmetic? What is the last digit of a number? Okay, mod 10. Does everybody agree with that? So how do we find the last digit of 2 to the 100 mod 10?
2 to the 200.
2 to the 200, that's a good number. 2 to the 100 times 2 to the 2? What is 2 to the 100? 2 to the 200 is 2 to the 100 times 2 to the 100. Okay? So if I knew what this was, that would tell me. What is 2 to the 100 mod 10? So now the problem reduces to 2 to the 100 mod 10. And what is that? What is that? It's 2 to the 50 mod 10. 2 to the 50 times 2 to the 50 mod 10. And what is 2 to the 50 mod 10? 2 to the 25 mod 10. 2 to the 25 small enough to compute yet? I don't think so. What is 2 to the 25?
No,
it's not 2 to the 5 times 2 to the 12. 2 to the 13 times 2 to the 12. That's probably true. Is there any other way to break it up that we know what the answer is? I think we could probably do this one here.
2 to the 5 plus 2 to the 5. No, yeah.
2 to the 5. How about 2 to the 5 times 2 to the 10 times 2 to the 10?
Okay.
What is 2 to the 10 mod 10? We talked about that one earlier, didn't we? So what's 2 to the 10 mod 10? 4. 4. What's 2 to the 5 mod 10?
2.
So what is 2 to the 25 mod 10? It is 1632. Mod 10, right? What is that? 2, right? Any questions about that? Okay.
Wait, did you get 32 again? 4. Oh, times, never mind.
2 times 4 times 4, times 4,
sorry,
right?
Yeah.
So this is 2 mod 10. Does everybody agree with that? What's 2 to the 50th mod 10 again? 4. 4 mod 10. What's 2 to the 100 mod 10? 4 times 4 mod 10, right? So that's 6.
I think is what I have on my slide, right?
Yeah, good. Okay. And what is 6 times 6 mod 10? 6 again. The answer is it's a 6. Does everybody see how we were able to work with an impossibly large number with modular arithmetic? That was sort of the key notion here. Okay? This is why modular arithmetic is a cool thing. Okay? So, the important thing that is
again, we're running out of time here. But I think this is a good point for you to make sure that you understand and see what we did here. Because I claim that this will help you with another one of the problems. Basically, with modular arithmetic, you can reduce the quantity of computing a huge number to computing its individual the residue of its individual components. Okay? And modular arithmetic works nicely on addition, subtraction, and multiplication, and exponentiation, but not for division. Okay? And so dealing with division is a more complicated thing. But modular arithmetic makes it very, very easy to compute incredibly large numbers without using large integers. Any questions? Okay? So if we take a look at the problems of the day, okay, I want to claim that modular arithmetic might provide a tool for helping you with that one. Okay? And you can think about that a little bit. Okay, any questions? Okay. So think about these. Try to get these two, I think I've set you up. So these two are now pretty soft. Okay? And it would be good if you guys could try to get those two right, and then we can try to talk about the harder ones next class. Okay? Any questions? Okay? And if you don't get them, it doesn't mean you're a bad person. So but you just do the best you can. Any questions? Okay, thanks a lot. See you tomorrow at Wolfram, and see you on Tuesday with all the other answers. Yeah. His talk will probably be an hour-ish. So, and you're free to walk out whenever you want. Okay, that's fine with me. He's a friend of mine.
So for the Carmichael numbers, while you're doing that, at the same time you're determining whether or not it's a composite number or not, it's normal.
Yeah, so you have to do normal things.
Okay.
Right. Okay, good. Okay, thanks a lot. See you guys then.